All right, to immigration. What did the Gang of Eight, or if you'd like to be nicer, the Group of Eight senators actually propose? And in its basis here, four bullet points. One, create a tough but fair path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants currently living here that is contingent upon securing our borders and tracking whether legal immigrants have left the country when required. Okay. Two, reform our legal immigration system to better recognize the importance of characteristics that will help build the American economy and strengthen American families. Okay. Three, create an effective employment verification system that will prevent identity theft and end the hiring of future unauthorized workers. And finally, four, establish an improved process for admitting future workers to serve our nation's workforce needs while simultaneously protecting all workers. That's some bold dreams and goals, and yet it is presented in kind of a vague, nebulous form. Now, if you're a new listener to the show, I have a theory. Actually, as a matter of fact, it's almost getting to be a part of my personal creed that if you want answers to things, especially our nation's problems, especially our nation's toughest problems, the best place to go is not necessarily the politicians. I think the best place to go is to historians. There are not enough historians talking about our nation's ills and solutions. And I'm doing my best to change that. So I welcome back, and very, very, very happy to welcome back the author of Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work, and the founder of History Speaks Today, Bruce Thatcher, is with us. Hello, Mr. Thatcher.
Hi, Chris. Hey, it's good to be back.
Yeah, it is. It's been a little bit too long, and thanks for reminding me. You know, you immediately put your finger on the proposals from the Gang of Eight. Am I being too mean by calling them that?
Well, everybody's calling them that. I think it's a good way to refer to them.
All right, fair enough. I just didn't want to get too much into, you know, Mao politics, but okay. You know, you've identified something, and it's not just the people here who are here now that they should be addressing, but it's the additional future immigrants. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I can. The if you looked at the four points there you just mentioned, two of them have to do with dealing with illegal immigrants and preventing, securing the border and everything.
And
those things can only be effective as they relate and coordinate with all of the other aspects of the immigration policy. And so I think we need to go back to the beginning of the thing and understand what this will mean. Take, for instance, a fair path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants. There's 10, 11, 12 million adult unauthorized immigrants in that category in this country. And before we resolve the status of those aliens, then we need to understand the ramifications within our existing immigration policy. And I'm not talking about respect for the law or fairness to those who are following the rules, though of course that's important. I'm talking about, and picture this, I'm talking about 10 to 20 or million or more additional future legal immigrants that amnesty and citizenship for these 10 million will bring to this country. And the reason for that, unless we change the basic immigration law.
Right.
And the reason for that's what people call chain immigration. I refer to it in my book as cascading immigration. Because what happens is we have, while we have about 600,000 or so theoretically a limitation on the immigrants who can come to this country.
Yes.
In fact, that's only part of it, because there's two categories of immigrants who are not limited numerically. And one of them is so-called close family.
Yes.
Of people who are already here, of U.S. citizens.
Yes.
And that's children, not adult children, but children.
Yes.
That's spouses, and that's parents.
Really? Parents, too.
Parents.
Yes.
Parents, too, of immigrants who are of citizens of the United States. So if these 10 million are granted a path to citizenship without dealing with this non-limited part, means as soon as they become citizens, they can bring in a great number of family.
You say up to as many as 20 million.
Well, here's why. Here's where I get that. When this law was passed, when Hart-Celler was passed in 1965, this provision was in the law, of course.
Yes.
And there were limitations on other family members. And in the 3 years or so following passage of Hart-Celler, the average number of immigrants who came in under this unlimited provision was about 30,000 a year.
Okay.
In the last 10 years, from 2001 to 2010, the average number of immigrants who came, of family immigrants who came in under this provision was 480,000 per year.
Oh, so 4.8 million over the course of 10 years. And again, just to make sure that the point is clear, these are people who are coming in addition to that single immigrant or who's either coming himself, gaining amnesty, and then bringing others with it. The close family is the 4.8 million, right?
Right.
Oh,
exactly right. So as soon as somebody becomes a citizen, they can bring in, without any numerical limitation, their close family. They can also bring in their extended family, but they come in under various preference limitations, which is why people complain about the long waiting times.
Yes.
That's because of the huge lineup of family members waiting to come into this country.
Is that the, I'm sorry, a doctor, a neurosurgeon from Senegal who is in a 7-year line to get his legal citizenship. Is he in the same line as the extended family of legal immigrants? Of immigrants that are already here?
No, he's got two choices.
Yeah.
Actually, he's got several choices, but let's just take the two. Mm. If he has a relative who's already in this country,
yes,
then he gets into one of the lines of these family, what I'll call family lines.
Yes.
He may also, however, be coming in under the employment-based annual limit of $140,000, and here's where people with skills, here's where people with professional training, here's where people with, such as the doctor, can come in, but they're limited to $140,000 a year, but beyond that, there's a limitation on every country from which immigrants come, and it is split between family and employment. So Senegal may have a very low number in terms of their limit because of their history, and when they come in, and that number then is further split about two-thirds family and one-third professional.
So we have a set limit for each country. Are there any exceptions? And, of course, I'm asking about Mexico and Guatemala, now that I think about it.
There are no exceptions for unless you're a refugee or an asylum seeker.
Okay.
With those exceptions, there are no exceptions. And third is the diversity lottery. There's a limit on that in total, but there's no per country limit within that lottery.
And I got to add this in before we go to a quick break here. Bruce Thatcher, by the way, founder of History Speaks Today and the author of Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work. The family immigrants, close family, extended family, are different from the original immigrant, if I understand this right, in that they're not required to meet any educational, language, or work experience criteria, and so therefore more likely to become burdens. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Family. Your only requirement, if your family, any of the family categories, is that your family and that you pass the restrictions that apply to all immigrants, such as you're not a felon and you're not a communist and you're not carrying a communicable disease and a number of other things like that.
Wow. So the original immigrant actually has slightly more restrictions on being able to get in legally than the family he then brings.
That may be.
Oh, wow.
That could be.
Hang tight for just a second, Bruce. We'll be right back.
Let's see. Where did the president talk about legal immigration? He said, once again, we have to deal with illegal immigration, securing our borders, enforcing our laws. We may not all get along with the solution, but it's something that has to be done. It's very simple. Secure your borders, enforce the laws, make E-Verify mandatory, develop a system and a policy of attrition by enforcement, and look at the United States Border Patrol, an agency which is in a run-and-gun battle down on our border, and look at how we can align them with the Department of Defense so they can get better equipping, better training, and we can have people that can transition out of Army, Marine Corps, Navy, whatever, use the tactics and the lessons they learned in Iraq and Afghanistan and bring it over to our border.
Chris Daniel on KMJ.
You need to make sure your child can speak Spanish.
Talk Radio, 105.9 FM, KMJ, and News Talk 580 KMJ. Chris Daniels here. Phone's opening shortly at 490-5858. Those are the words of Alan West, not part of the Gang of Eight. And we are listening to the words tonight, today, excuse me, of Bruce Thatcher. He is here. He is the author of Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work, indicating a man who is definitely in favor of immigration, but a solid immigration policy. He's also, of course, the founder of History Speaks Today. We're trying to take a historical look at this as we break down what the Gang of Eight was talking about. And I might have been just a little skewed, Bruce, in my last question to you earlier about the close family and the extended family immigrants who would also come after the first immigrant, adding perhaps 10 to 20 million people on top of what they're talking about. But I think what you pointed out was that what the Gang of Eight has proposed about an additional background check, paying taxes, learning English and civics, demonstrating a work history, that does not necessarily apply to the family immigrants, does it?
No. These criteria have been proposed to apply to the illegal immigrants who are already here. But they don't apply to, in order to become an immigrant to the United States, you do not have to know English. You don't have to know anything about the society or the government of our country. You don't have to have a history of work except for some of the immigrants who come in under the employment category, but not as family. You don't have to have those things to come here as family. So,
wow.
The additional family who come in, either unrestricted or restricted, don't necessarily have these criteria apply.
And that historically has been the case, has it not?
It has. It has since Hart Celler.
Wow. See that to me again. We're so worried in this country about hurting anybody's feelings at any possible time. It indicates to me kind of an underrunning core theme to how we deal with and talk about immigration now, and that is national interest versus personal interest. We seem to be so worried about hurting the feelings of the immigrant who wants to be here or the immigrant who is already here in any status than we are about, you know, how can this immigration, which built our country, continue to build our country instead of, you know, burden it down? Am I right on that?
Oh, well, I think you're right.
I do.
You read all the news headlines, news stories and everything about the illegal immigrants, and they all are concerned with the plight of the illegal immigrant. And the plights are real. I don't deny that. But I don't hear anybody talking about what's good for the United States.
Or even, quite frankly, the plight of the legal immigrant, the one who is in that line spending thousands of dollars and waiting 10 years.
And they do spend thousands of dollars, too. I have personal experience with that I probably told you when we talked before, and I think most people who know immigrants who have come to this country have personal experience with how much they have spent.
Could you tell that story again,
going through the red tape.
Yeah, tell it again, though. That would be interesting to hear again.
Oh, I have a friend of mine who used to work with in Washington, mm-hmm. Is from Singapore. And she came here 8 years ago or 10 years ago or something like that. I don't know exactly what year she came. And applied 8.5 years ago, from 9 years ago now, to get a green card.
Yes.
She got it 6 months ago. And she spent thousands of dollars on lawyer fees because our maze of immigration regulations is just almost impossible to navigate without help from a lawyer. It's just incredible.
What did she bring to the table? I'm curious.
She brought management.
Yes.
Of communication activities.
Terrific.
To the table. She was an college graduate, university graduate from Singapore.
Now, I know that English is the language of Singapore, so I'm assuming she spoke English as well.
It is. Singapore is an interesting country in that English is not their official language. It is, they have three official languages because of their racial...
Malay, Chinese, and English, right? Is that right?
Malay, Chinese, and Indian.
Oh.
But English is the official business language.
Ah.
And virtually everybody who goes to school in Singapore has to learn English.
So basically the message there is, Marty talks, Malay walks.
I haven't heard that, but yeah, yeah. Right? No, what they said was one of the things that we have to have to have a cohesive society is everybody speaking the same language. And because they're multiracial, they couldn't pick any one of the racial languages that were there. They picked the English language that came from the colonial days.
Of course, and everybody agreed to it because it made sense, even the people that had always been there. You know, you talked, Bruce, we're with Bruce Thatcher again on KMJ. You talked about the maze of immigration in the legal sense. Do you get the sense then that even the various agencies who handle bits and pieces of the immigration process, do they understand the other agencies? Do they have as many bureaucratic problems with the other agencies as the immigrant does?
Well, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But it's hard to feel otherwise because all of the agencies that dealt with immigration until the Department of Homeland Security came along were all under the Justice Department. Now they are all under Homeland Security, with the exception of one small agency that's still under Justice, but they're split into three distinctly different operations. One is Border Control,
right.
one is Customs, and one is Enforcement, which is ICE.
Yes.
And I don't have any evidence that they particularly talk to each other. Each one does their own thing or not, as they're directed to do.
Wow.
It's bewildering. And
especially if you're new to the country and you don't speak the language, perhaps, or you do barely. I mean, I can only imagine what it must be like.
Yeah, you hired a lawyer to get in, maybe. You're going through this process and everything, and you have to go somewhere for help. Where you go for help, for the most part, is some non-government agency that is set up particularly to help you.
Yeah.
If you're a Hispanic, then you go to one group. If you're Italian, you go to another group. If you're from Bulgaria, you go to another group, because all of them are very ethnocentric in terms of the way they're set up.
Well, that's likely a natural result of the process being so confusing and full of pitfalls that you're naturally going to gravitate to people of your ilk and culture and language, right?
Oh, I think that's unquestionably true, and that's the pattern that you see in all countries where there are immigrants of coming in from different nationalities.
You know, I wonder, maybe you've seen it, I never have, are the documents and forms for legally immigrating to this country, are they only in English or are they bilingual?
They are in multilingual.
Okay, that would have been too good.
One could argue, and certainly there's a fair chunk of people who do argue that they and everything else the government does ought to be only in English.
Yes.
And that may be a nativist argument for many. That is also an argument that deals with the question of assimilation, in my opinion, because the more we require the people who immigrate to this country to already speak English, the faster they will assimilate into the country and be able to function effectively.
Oh, a single language immigration form is, in fact, the policy of the Republic of Mexico. So, we're going to do a quick news check here. We're with Bruce Thatcher. When we come back, we're going to get the historian's perspective on other nations that they studied, seven of them, and who have successful immigration policies and how they work. And one of the things I love most about Bruce is he doesn't come to just complain. He also comes with answers, and we'll talk to him about his formula for a successful American immigration policy, a six-point plan. Can we talk a little bit about successful immigration in the countries that have managed to pull it off?
Yeah, we sure can.
Were you part of that study?
We were part of the study, actually, because our first two immigration policies were successful policies. The first one ran from when we became a country in about 1789 all the way up to 1921, and it was essentially an open immigration policy.
Mm-hmm.
We clearly needed to settle the land. We needed to bring in people who could run our industry, and so we took in just about everybody. Not quite, but just about everybody for that period of time. 1921, it changed. People decided we didn't need people to settle the land anymore, and now we had to be more careful about our standard of living and such things. So they instituted a quota policy, which was correctly designed to maintain a constant demography,
yes,
demographic profile of the country. And that went on till 1965, and we changed again to what we call a preference policy with Hart Celler, and
and
I have at least six different goals that was supposed to achieve, and the problem is they conflict with each other.
Do you think
you can't win them.
In your opinion, Bruce, was the middle policy that you talked about that ended in 1965, was that at all racist with the preferential demographics?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, it just had to be.
Yeah, it was. Sure it was.
But is a country almost exclusively the history of immigration in most countries, and certainly this one, is that you come in at the bottom rung of the ladder. You know, you're going to be doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do. Is a nation saying that's how it is, that's how this country was built, is that a racist policy?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
The bottom rung of the ladder was filled by, I can go back and think how I was born and grew up, and it was pretty near the bottom. And so I think that starting at the bottom and working up is not at all necessarily racist.
As long as that ladder has a top, and there's no ceiling somewhere. As long as can climb as high as you want to go. Nor do I think so. Do you think that's changed, though? I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. That, you know, I mean, the history of our country with, you know, the Irish and then the Slavs and the Germans and the Italians and the involuntary immigration of the Africans and, you know, out in Hawaii, the Japanese and the Filipinos. Every single group started at the very bottom rung of the ladder. Is there a sense now in entitlement America that's somehow wrong, that you shouldn't have to start with $13,000 a year?
We have, I think, in entitlement America, we have a very much growing entitlement philosophy. We're looking for equality of outcomes, not equality of opportunity.
Right.
And we're saying, we're looking at micro cases, at specific anecdotal cases, and saying, look at that situation with that family. Isn't that awful? We'd better pass a law so that never happens again.
Without ever checking out what their status was in the country of origin.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the people, particularly the immigrants who come over here, most of them are coming over here to better their economic position. You know, there was a recent Gallup survey worldwide, which showed that 550 million adults prefer to live elsewhere, somewhere other than where they're living now.
Yes.
And the United States was the first choice of 23% of them, which comes to 150 million adults. So there's a lot of people who want to come here.
Oh, yeah. Our local ROTC colonel, who's on the show from time to time, who is of Hispanic nature, says this is the only country on the planet where people will literally die to get here.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. And that being the case, we need to have criteria to manage the number, because obviously we can't take in next year 150 million immigrants or anything approaching that.
And you have stated, again, if you just joined us late, guys, the initial statement from Bruce about the proposal from the Gang of Eight is that it only concentrates on the immigrant himself and not the close family and then the extended family immigrants that come afterwards. They're not even subject to the same criteria in coming here. That's how he gets his totals.
Yeah, that's right. Now, into the guts of immigration reform, they'll go in and they'll take care of, you know, they'll fix those things or they'll address those things, but we're not talking about them now. And I think that everybody who wants to address immigration needs to understand and realize those things. Every country that I know of has a limit on their immigration. I don't know any country that has any segment of their immigration that's open like more than half of ours is.
No question.
Every country establishes a limit of how many immigrants they'll take in based upon a variety of economic and other conditions as to how fast, whether they need them in their industry or in their country, what their goals are. We pretend to do that with our existing immigration law, but we don't do it.
No, we don't.
We have such a huge chunk that's open. And with so many people wanting to come to the United States, we don't need to be so complicated about allocating priorities and allocating preferences for various groups, because if we establish a few criteria and select the people we want to come in, the market will take care of bringing us the talents and the skills and the abilities that we want to have to come into this country.
Well,
and
million,
they're there.
Absolutely. Any club would tell you this, but not only that, but any employer over the past 4 or 5 years of rampant unemployment will tell you, yeah, you know, to tell you the truth, man, I raised my hiring standards because I could afford to. There were plenty of people to pick from. It's astounding. But Bruce, excuse me for interrupting, but I've been notified now that when I mentioned the historical groups that have come to this country through immigration, I listed everybody except the Scandinavians, and apparently somebody called, wanted to be included, and we have not, of course, forgotten the Danes, the Swedes, and the Finns, the Norwegians, and the Swedes. You did a wonderful job. Thank you. I'm from Minnesota. Thanks for helping build it. people get picky, man.
You know, there's a recitation of all that in one of the cases in my book. And there are groups that you haven't even mentioned here. There's a lot of groups
Yes. Who
have come to this country and have become a part of the basic culture and the basic strength of America.
Yeah, well, I can always count on Kingsburg, California, if ever there's a slight to the Swedes, okay? You know, you did a study on this. You studied seven nations that you consider to have successful immigration policies. You mentioned that they adhere to three principles, and what were they?
Well, the three principles, number one, is that you begin with a clear definition of what is the national interest that is to guide immigration policy.
Right.
And in the early years of the United States, for instance, that was populate the land. That was
right.
Also the case in Australia and in Canada in their early years, and has been the case in many places, populate the land. It could be, however, economic. It could be family as part of what we have now. It could be any of a dozen or more different national interests. But if you don't have a defined national interest, if you don't know where you're going with the policy, then any road will get you there.
Right. Hey, I'm curious. Go ahead. Please finish. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just saying, the problem is that your immigration law will have a lot of contradictory aspects in it if you don't have that guiding.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Australia and Canada because those are two very large countries that were, you know, 90% of their land or more is unpopulated because it isn't much fun to live in the Australian outback or in the Arctic in Canada. Have they kept that policy of populate the land, or have they also shifted, knowing that that's about the best they're going to get?
Australia doesn't have it, that's, I'm sorry, Australia does have a populate the land as part of what they need to do.
All right.
They got very sensitive with World War II when they were afraid they were going to be invaded by Japan.
Yes.
And had a populate or perish kind of mentality come upon them. That's only one. Their primary one, however, has to do with skills and employment and economic vitality. Canada does not have a particular populate the land as part of their immigration strategy anymore. And, of course, the United States doesn't. Interestingly enough, a little country like Singapore still does have population growth as one of the things that immigration is supporting.
Wow.
And the reason it does is because even though they only have 7 million people, 7 or 8 million people, their birth rate is not enough to sustain population growth.
Well, maybe the modesty laws are kicking into gear on this one.
Well, I don't think so because, you know, in the United States, our birth rate has now dropped below the maintenance level just this past year. Okay. And if that continues, then we'll, and many European countries are in that fix as well.
Yes.
We'll get to the point where we either immigrate or we stagnate.
With those numbers, I'm just curious, before we go to break, does that include the illegal immigration population in this country?
Birth rates do.
Okay.
They include that. Yes.
Even still. All right, when we get back with Bruce Thatcher in our final break here, his formula for successful American immigration policy as we try to break down the proposals from the Gang of Eight. All right, we've beat up the Gang of Eight. We've asked questions about the national philosophy and whether it's wrong on immigration. And we've talked about other countries. What about the solutions coming from you, sir?
Well, I think there's a number of based upon immigration's role in America being to enhance the vitality and growth of the economy.
Yes.
We talked about putting numeric on immigration. And we sort of talked about and skirted around the idea of getting rid of all these preferences, lottery that goes with them, so that instead of having six or eight lines for immigrants to get into to come into the country, we only have one.
Yes.
I think that this assimilation is a big problem, and so I think I would require that each applicant for an immigrant visa demonstrate general literacy appropriate for their age and also demonstrate English fluency so that they could function effectively
yes.
in the country without assistance. I would deny immigrant visas to people, to radical Islam, Salafi and Wahhabism and others that adhere to violent jihad. Actually, these people, clerics and teachers of these particular persuasions, are currently protected under a preference for immigration into this country under the employment-based limits.
Wow.
Sure change that. I would absolutely have a streamlined program to bring in temporary and guest workers needed to relieve genuine shortages. We have about a million or so of those in the country right now.
You've got them right here in the San Joaquin Valley. I mean, this past grape season, it was hard. I know guys who were just let it go. They couldn't find people to work. I saw guys work pruning nectarines at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Almost 25% of the entire population of Singapore are workers of this category, temporary. They
wow.
happen to be high tech, but they're temporary and they're not eligible for immigration. There's a couple of other kinds of things, but I think that we get down to enforcing the immigration laws, and there's some things we can do. We talk about the Gang of Eight says, let's have a trigger that says we can take care of the status of the illegal immigrants here once we enforce the laws. And to do that, they're proposing we pass more laws. But the problem is that the Congress can't enforce the laws. Only the executive can enforce the laws, and the executive historically has chosen to do that only selectively.
And every law by its own nature creates more bureaucracy anyway.
It does. Singapore has an interesting law to deal with that problem. If a government official fails to enforce immigration law or abets, helps an immigrant to come in illegally,
mm-hmm.
that official is subject to the same penalties that apply to the illegal immigrant. And
no.
those in Singapore include jail time and maybe caning.
Whoa! We've only got about 90 seconds, but you talk about eliminating the preferential system. Before we completely throw that away, is it just the wrong preferential system? In my mind, I can envision almost a kind of a union hall kind of situation where there's a board that says what America needs right now in terms of labor all the way up to the highest possible positions, and that's how we set our immigration policy on a day-by-day, need-by-need basis. Is that insane?
No, it's not insane. Australia, Canada, and Singapore all do that in one fashion or another. It creates a bureaucracy. My personal preference is to let the market work,
yeah.
but certainly the successful countries are doing that.
Bruce, then the final question, how do we convince America that that's a positive thing to do and not a negative, racist, you know, whatever agendaed thing that they want to accuse you of?
I think by making America aware of some of the realities of the numbers. The idea that, hey, there's 150 million people and their families wanting to come here. We can't take them all. We're going to have to make decisions as to who can come here. So, and any time you make decisions like that, you're being discriminatory. That isn't necessarily racist. That isn't necessarily evil. But everybody in America makes decisions and choices, which means some people can come and some people can't.
And they mirror those decision processes, absolutely. Bruce, I got to cut you loose, but I thank you for coming back. I can't wait to have you back already. And thanks for the hour you gave us.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, Bruce Thatcher, everybody, from History Speaks Today. He is their founder at HistorySpeaks.com. Sorry, HistorySpeaksToday.com. And the author of Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work.